Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, here I am.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest this morning is Laura Levine. She is a life coach, writer, public speaker, artist, and the author of Pink Hair and Chocolate Cookies, Real Life Lessons from a Real Life Coach. For the past 6 years, Laura has worked with a wide variety of clients, ranging from single moms to CEOs, helping them clarify their desires, navigate transitions, and moving towards achieving their dreams. She's here to talk about her life's journey, her book, Pink Hair and Chocolate Cookies, and her passion as an organic gardener. Good morning, Laura. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, John. I'm great. I'm so glad to be here.
Good. I'm really glad to have you here. You know, after reading your book, you really have a great sense of humor. I really enjoyed reading it, and it's an easy read, and it's I like the various real-life stories that you have compiled in putting this book together. I'd like to get started with talking about your life's journey. Laura, please tell us about your life from childhood to the present moment.
In 3 minutes.
That was quick.
Well, I was born in Paris, France, right outside of Paris. No, I was born in Paris, actually. Mm-hmm. Grew up right outside of Paris till I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 16, my parents moved to the States, and mm-hmm. they moved to Florida. So after I graduated from high school, I moved pretty unwillingly to the States.
Mm, okay.
That's kind of the story in itself, but moved to the States and really wanted to move back to France, but not really knowing how to do that. I got a job. I think the French accent helped. I got a job doing makeup I ended up doing makeup. Mm-hmm. Somehow I found myself a career as a makeup artist
mm-hmm.
for the fashion industry and movie industry.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was 18, I was really on my way to a pretty successful career in the makeup world.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually I moved to Chicago and started doing a lot of makeup work. I worked for Playboy for a couple of years, which I don't always tell everybody. And, you know, had a good 10-year career, moved to Hawaii, worked on movies there, worked with a lot of different productions, and then met my kid's husband, my husband's kids, see in French, mm-hmm. back, my husband's mm-hmm. kids, and eventually moved to Washington, kind of faded out of the movie makeup career,
mm-hmm.
started an organic garden where mm-hmm. we were growing herbs and selling them to restaurants, and then by some crazy coincidence, which is the subject of my next book, which is called Once Upon a Bakery, we opened a French bakery.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran that for 10 years, just about 10 years. I ended up with two bakeries. Mm-hmm. And then after that, by that time we had three kids, and our marriage dissolved, and we got divorced. And mm-hmm. then I kind of floundered for a while, not quite sure what I was doing here on this island, unable to live. I live on a little island in the Pacific Northwest, and with a shared custody, I couldn't leave.
Mm-hmm.
One day, heard about life coaching and wasn't sure what that was about, checked it out, and realized that, you know, this was what I was meant to do for sure. So just embarked passionately and fiercely onto a life coaching career, and that's mm-hmm. what I've been doing for the last 6 years.
I see. Well, in your book, you mentioned about how your dad was very successful in building his calendar publishing business, and how does that help you in shaping your entrepreneurial life?
Well, it helped me because, you know, it's sort of a mixed bag. It helped mm-hmm. me a lot because, in a way, it demystified entrepreneurship for me. I never ever considered getting a job. I've never had a job. I've never mm-hmm. you know, worked for anyone else, really.
Mm-hmm.
So it allowed me to see things as wide open. There was no impossibility. I mean, I saw my dad do incredible feats. So nothing ever felt scary.
Mm-hmm.
on the other hand, you know, maybe it would have been good for me to consider getting a job a few times. It just never crossed my mind. I mean, when my kid's dad and I got divorced and I had no money and times were really tough, all I could think of is what kind of business can I build really quick? And I ended up building, you know, I was thinking, well, what do I have? I know I have a washing machine and I have a dryer. So I started a business called the Laundry Fairy that picked up people's laundry and washed it and returned it. So, you know, in one way it was really helpful because I have that vision. But on the other hand, it also pretty much prevented me from ever considering a regular lifestyle.
Right.
Well, so like most things, you know, it was a mixed bag.
But that's fantastic, though, because what happens is that it gives you the opportunity to experiment out there and do something different. And, of course, I'm sure, you know, in your book you talk a great deal about your family in some ways, about, you know, some of the stories that you've learned, lessons and everything else. But going back to your 20s, you know, that's where you were in the fashion and movie industry as a makeup artist. Tell us, what was that like? I mean, what kind of lessons did you learn going through that transition?
I learned first of all that this wasn't where I wanted to be forever. There was definitely a discongruency between the fashion and movie world and my personality. But I also learned that for sure it was important to make a lot of money in the least amount of time. I learned the value of a high hourly rate. And actually, when I left that career, I really wanted to have a normal life, and we moved into the mountains, and I got a job making sandwiches in a ski resort. And when I got my paycheck, I was just horrified. So I learned that it's great to make, you know, a good amount of money in a short amount of time. I think I started coaching there because, you know, when you're sitting with a model or an actor, that you have the most time of anyone with them, you know, one-on-one. And there's a lot of really wonderful connection that goes on. So I think I started coaching then, you know, hours and hours spent with someone with a pretty high-pressure job on their part. And just talking to them and helping them get ready for whatever was coming up for them, a runway event or a movie or, you know, some scene, some heavy.
You must be a good listener then, obviously, because it comes naturally to you at a young age being able to listen to someone else and the fact that, you know, you're able to absorb that and in return offer something of value back to them.
Yeah, I'm pretty fascinated with people's lives. You know, I'm pretty fascinated with what makes people do what they do. So I think I come at it with a pretty big curiosity. So I always want to know more. So it's like, okay, well, tell me more about that. And tell me more about that. And by the time you've asked someone to really clarify where they are, they've clarified for themselves where they want to go.
Right. That's true, because it's a lot of times you find that they just need someone, an outlet, for someone to talk and without offering a whole lot of opinion, but just to listen.
Yeah.
Very much so. Well, let's fast forward for a few years here. And you were a mom. I mean, you are a mom still, I'm sorry. But you are a mom. And did you develop your own mothering skills, or did you draw from your experiences with growing up with, you know, with your mom and your grandmother and so forth?
I think I did a lot of my own inventing. My parents were really busy when I was growing up. From the age of 7 on, they were really busy with their careers, and I spent a lot of time alone. And I think that when my kids were born, I wanted to do it differently. And I might have even erred on the side of doing it completely differently. For instance, people laughed when my kids were born. I wouldn't put them down till they begged to walk. So for two years, basically hold my kids. And, you know, since they were close in age, sometimes I would hold one in my arm and carry one in my back. But, you know, I'm sure somewhere I picked up something from my own growing up, but a lot of it I kind of invented along the way. And also, you know, such a different lifestyle. I mean, I grew up in Paris where my parents were pretty pretty high profile social people. With we had when I grew up, we had, let's see, three maids living, three living living ladies that worked with my, you know, someone cooked, someone cleaned, someone raised the kids. And when I raised my kids, for the first couple of years, we lived in a little trailer and in the woods. That was a very different setup.
Right, right. I mean, how was that, you know, like the change, I mean, for you as far as that goes? I mean, would you, I mean, would you somewhat, the word may not be, you know, like rebelling, but, you know, like obviously you came up with a very different setup, with a very structured family. Like you say, you have nannies, you have a whole household staff, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Getting everything done very formal. And I was in Paris, I think I told you that, you know, several years back, and it was a fascinating place to go. And so I understand the culture, the concept. And actually, when I grew up in Malaysia, we have a lot of the European influence. And I have friends that have all that amenities that goes with it, I guess, in this case. And so it's just a little bit different. So how do you make that adjustment from that, and then all of a sudden right now having your own family, and you, like you mentioned, you're now in a trailer? That must be a you know, a major paradigm shift for you, you know, from
it was great. It was it was rebellion. It was it was absolutely, you know, I made peace with it. It took a while to understand what happened, but I think the way it worked is from the age of birth till seven, it was my mom and my dad and me, and we lived a fairly normal middle-class life. When I turned seven, my family made a lot of money. My dad sold his company, so made a lot of money. And from that time on, life shifted greatly. And while my parents were always very wonderful, there was a lot less closeness and warmth. And I think somewhere in my mind, I decided that money had taken away the closeness, maybe, or the or the warmth. And so I think I made a subconscious agreement that for sure I wasn't going to let that happen in my life.
Right, right.
And
you mentioned that
point,
in your book. You mentioned that in your book, too, and that's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think it's those agreements we make, you know, and we don't always really realize we make them. And it, for me, was even to the point of rebelling against money. And deciding that money had caused some level of separation. Therefore, I was going to make sure that I lived in a trailer and I had to scramble for diaper money. And that was going to make ensure that we had a very loving, close-knit family. And it's silly, but it's the stuff that we do without even thinking about it.
Right. You're going, you went from a far right, whichever that is, you know, all the way to the far left.
Exactly.
And,
I think only in the last 10 years I've come to center.
Okay, that's good. I was going to ask you that. When do you finally, you know, drifted towards the middle and find a balance and realizing that, you know, like we are in control of ourselves and we're in control of everything we do, actually. And then we navigate and we make those wonderful decisions that we want to do. And that, of course, brings up the next question to be, you know, I know informally you were, as you had mentioned, you were somehow coaching people along the way, and but this is your natural gift. But what actually motivates you to become a life coach?
Well, actually, my sister did. What happened was, so we got separated and divorced, sold the bakery, no money at all at that point, on my own with three kids, although we were sharing, you know, custody, but still it felt very much on my own, you know, doing the little laundry business and pretty much floundering. And kind of hit bottom, and I realized I'm stuck here on this island for the next 15 years, no matter which way I look at it. And I was having a late-night conversation with my sister, who was in, I think she was in Paris at the time, and telling her I don't know what to do. And I had been listening to her over the years a lot. And she said, you know, there is a profession you might really enjoy, and that's life coaching. And I thought, you know, I've never heard of life coaching. What is that? So we said goodbye, and I couldn't sleep, and I woke up. I got up. I got out of bed, and I went downstairs to the computer and plugged in life coaching to see what the heck she was talking about. And I sat at the computer till the came in the morning because I was just so just fascinated and enamored with the fact that here, there on the screen was exactly the description of what I wanted to do and what I'd been doing. So then it was a fast and furious 3 month training. I mean, I lived, breathed, and drank life coaching. I did my lessons on my earphones, and I walked for the whole summer. I couldn't get enough. I could not get enough. I was just like starved for more. Mm-hmm. And that's how I started my career.
I mean, it's obviously a natural calling for you, and you just found it and it became natural. In your book, I really like the story about a dash of cinnamon for peace. I know we can all use that, you know, wonderful advice in our daily lives. Please tell us a little bit more about this.
You want me to tell you about the story?
Yes, the dash of cinnamon for peace.
Oh, that's a good story. That was that took place many, many years ago before we had kids. My ex-husband and I were talking about adopting. We had this idea that we wanted to adopt, and through the course of that, we met a lady who did home studies, and she was telling us about a home study she had just done, and she was really tickled with the coincidences, and what I took from it was a little different. So what she told us was that there were two twin little girls mm-hmm. who had been adopted at birth, and it was an open adoption. And one of the clauses of the adoption was that every couple of years they were supposed to get monitored and a report sent to the birth mom. And that at some point, I think at 15, they were going to meet. So she had just done the report for their, I think they were either two or four at the time. So she went to the first family. The little girls had been adopted into two different homes. Mm-hmm. So she went to the first family. And she met the mom, and she asked her a series of questions. And one of the questions was, how is your daughter's eating habits? And the mom said, oh, my gosh, it is a nightmare. It is just so difficult to get this kid to eat. She won't eat anything. Every meal is a battle. And the only way she'll eat something is if I sprinkle cinnamon on it. And it is really, really difficult. We have fights all the time. So she noted that and other details about the kid's life mm-hmm. and then went to the other family and did the same interview with the other mom. And so she said, so what is your little girl's eating habit like? And the mom said, she's great. She's just the easiest eater. She's wonderful. She'll eat anything. Anything I put in front of her, she'll eat, as long as I sprinkle a little cinnamon on it.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, so all we do is keep a little shaker of cinnamon on the table, and meals are a real joy. And, you know, the lady was just, she loved the fact that both twins love cinnamon. But to me, it just stuck in my mind. I thought, oh, my gosh, these kids have the same requirement. And one mom has made it war, mm-hmm. and one mom has used it as a tool for just an easy life. And it was exactly the same situation. And that just really, really stuck with me as really, really important.
I think it's a wonderful story.
We're given, but what we do with it is the difference. And so, you know, if you decide to go to war because someone likes cinnamon, then you just live with a war.
I agree what you had said with regards to the idea of we have a choice. I mean, we can create that positive energy versus creating the negative energy and forcing the issue in
of
this
course.
Case. And that's what I got from reading it. And I, of course, I enjoyed the fact that, you know, you talked about the adoption and everything else because I was adopted at birth. And in the course of my book and talk about the nine different moms that I've met, you know, over my life thus far. But it was just the idea of, you know, okay, we all have choices that we can choose to either go against the grain or go with the grain, and I believe you used the word stress. Do we want to stress out over something like that?
That's right. Do we want to be right? You know, that cliche sentence, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? I mean, what the heck does it matter to sprinkle cinnamon?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very true. And you also wrote about keeping that wheels turning, and this is about life and not lifestyle. You distinguish the difference between life and lifestyle. How does this help someone applying it to themselves?
Well, you know, one thing I do a lot in my work is mm-hmm. I try to get people to really see what matters to them, not what they've been raised with, not what they see their neighbors doing, not what they think someone say about them, but what really works for you. And your life is kind of like a canvas, and do you want to make it so the painting looks good for you or the painting looks good for your neighbors? So I think it's just really important to pay attention to what do you value, and then take actions that are going to reflect those values, as opposed to what should you value, mm-hmm. or what are you being asked to value. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And of course, in your situation, where, and this comes back to the idea when you were making that paradigm shift from living a different lifestyle in France and coming here and getting married and living a totally different lifestyle. And because you were making a statement, say, hey, this is how I want to live. And obviously, like, say, from, you know, all the way from the right to the left, and then you found the paradigm shift somewhere within the last 10 years or so to get to the middle. And yeah. And that's why I brought it up, because I thought it was very interesting, because we often get confused between the two. And I've got a lot of people, I met someone a while back that mentioned to me about, if only I lower my standards, so I change my standards. And after knowing what her standards are, in all actuality, she really don't have any standards. I mean, she does, but, you know, standard is what standard does, I guess, in terms of, you know, her standards may be what considered shallow to other people, and to other people maybe, you know, a wonderful set of standards. So it just all depends on each individual, you see.
Right.
And I brought it up simply because, you know, it's the life or the lifestyle that you choose that makes the difference. That is, you know, what I'm alluding to here. As a founding member of the International Association of Coaches, I mean, you, again, this is part of the entrepreneurial spirit that you're involved with. What makes someone a great coach?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. Well, first of all, how do you know that you're a great coach? I guess you know mm-hmm. you're a great coach. I'm kind of thinking that as I answer to you. I guess you know you're a great coach, and I don't know that you're a great coach all the time, but when people are happier, I would say that, when people are happier after working with you than they were before they started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be definitely a good litmus test.
Okay.
And what makes that happen? Listening, a lot of listening. Mm-hmm. You know, I just read this interview by Thomas J. Leonard, or with Thomas J. Leonard, who's the founder of Life Coaching and a great mentor of mine. And that interview was done in 1996, which is, you know, when life coaching was in its infancy. I mean, it was really, really early on. And someone asks him, what's a life coach? And he says, a life coach is a part motivational speaker, part sounding board, part consultant, part therapist, and part rent-a-friend.
That's true. Very
so
true.
You take all this together, and you end up with a pretty powerful combination.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do all of these cleanly, meaning without too much of your own filters, and also, you know, a certain degree of experience, because for me, I work mostly with women, so I've had a lot of experience as a woman, as a mom, as a wife, as a, you know, many, many experiences. So you bring your experience, you bring your ear, you bring your intuition. I work a lot through intuition. And you bring your willingness to be surprised. Mm-hmm. You don't start with an outcome in mind. Mm-hmm. You just kind of trust that you're going to get exactly where you need to go, even if you didn't know at the beginning where that was going to be. You bring your curiosity. And usually really good stuff happens.
I'm sure it does, because as you create that, you manifest it in your mind, and then you just go with it and be trusting and have faith.
Yes, and also on the part of the client to be trusting that mm-hmm. they have found the right person to partner with. It's a bit of a partnership, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's come back to your book, Pink Hair. Tell us about that.
Pink hair. Pink hair refers to one of the stories in the book, which is a day when I was at a play with a girlfriend, and there was intermission came, and we went into the hall, and I looked across the hall, and I saw this head of pink hair. And actually, I have a sequel for this story that's not in the book. Mm-hmm. So I saw this head of pink hair, and it was a very old woman who had this head of pink hair. So I made a beeline zoom to her because I wanted to know what was going on, why she had pink hair. And I got to her, and she was pretty old indeed. And I asked her why she had pink hair, and she said, well, I got cast as the fairy godmother in Cinderella. And mm-hmm. they asked me if I would dye my hair pink, and I said, well, sure, I would. So she dyed her hair pink, and she said that during the show, you know, while the show was going on, everywhere she went, people were just so uplifted by her hair. Like, little kids would want to touch it, and adults smiled whenever she walked anywhere, into the grocery store and everywhere. And she realized that she was able to bring joy and smiles, probably because she was so old, you know, with that pink hair. Wherever she went, she was like a billboard for joy and silly. And so after the show ended, she decided to keep her hair pink. And she said to me, so that was a couple years ago, and then her friend was there, and she said, no, that was 10 years ago. So she was getting old, and then the show started, and I lost her. Mm-hmm. And I always, and so then I wrote the book, the book is a big homage to her. You know, she really stuck in my mind. I had really wanted to spend more time with her. And so, do you want me to tell you a little bit more about that?
Yeah, please do.
That's something I haven't told anyone. But so one day last year, I was doing a reading of the book in a group with a group of people. And after I finished reading that one story, I said, you know, I would have loved to spend more time with her. And someone raised their hand, and they said, I know her, and I know where she is.
Wow.
And I was so excited. And it was right before Christmas, like December 20th or something. So they promised to email me your information in the morning. Well, sure enough, 6 a.m., bing, on my inbox comes her address. And it turns out she lives in a retirement home. So I get on the phone and I ask, can we come visit her? They said, sure, come on over. So my partner and my son and I head in the car and go to find her. We find out that she's actually in the wing for people who need a little bit more assistance because her mind is starting to go. Mm-hmm. So we get to the right wing, but on the way there, there is a thing on the wall that says all the birthdays for December. And sure enough, her birthday is the same as my birthday.
I'll be done.
So I was so excited. You know, I felt such a kinship with her. Mm-hmm. So finally we get to the nurse's station, and they call her, and the doors open. And here she comes, pink sweatshirt, pink pants, pink hair, and pink nail polish. And she's so beautiful. And she definitely is, you know, she has Alzheimer's without doubt. But she is just so lovely. And she said, oh, I haven't seen you in so long. You know, she doesn't remember us, but she took us to her little apartment and talked to us forever. And I read her story, which was too much for her to really grasp. Mm-hmm. But we held hands, and oh, she was wonderful. And when we left, she told the nurses that I was her daughter. And I asked her if she would like me to come back for her birthday. And she said, sure, that would be lovely. Mm-hmm. So a week later, we came back for her birthday. So we got there. And we brought a cake, and we called her in, and we had cake, and we lit the candles. Mm-hmm. Well, the candles set off the fire alarm in the whole nursing room.
Oh, no.
The whole nursing wing. Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. So within minutes, the whole fire department is there. And you have all these ladies walking around panicked, and it's so terrible. And Virginia, that's her name, turns towards a nurse. And says, Nellie, am I safe? And the nurse says, yeah, Virginia, you're safe. And she says, oh, then it's all wonderful. And that's all she needed to know, if she was safe. And then everything was great. And she has that personality that it's infectious. She is so light and joyful and positive, and she laughs, and you know, from one moment to the next, she forgets who I am, and she kind of gets reacquainted all over again with curiosity and delight. And so anyway, I blabble forever about her because she's definitely my hero, and the gift of the book was to be able to reconnect with her.
I mean, it's a wonderful story about her, and certainly I appreciate you sharing for the first time, you know, the second half of the story about the pink hair lady. I mean, my only experience with a pink hair lady, ironically, I do have one. She was a lady that I met long time ago when I first started ballroom dancing. And it was part of my late ballroom instructor's mom's group, because my late ballroom instructor mom, I mean, she was in ballroom dancing back in the 50s, I believe, and she even actually taught the 1958 LSU championship football team how to ballroom dance one summer. And but she has all these people following her for 20, 30 something years, and in the course of, but in, I guess this was about 10, 12 years ago that she got me and said, you know, well, you need to get into ballroom dancing, it's good for you. And they were recruiting young blood, so to speak, to get into ballroom dancing. So I really enjoyed it. I'm so glad I did it back then, because now I really enjoy it, because ballroom dancing is really cool now. Back then it wasn't. I mean, you don't want to go out and tell people you do ballroom dancing as a young man, because you know, people might think you're conflicted or something. And so I kid around about, you know, I kid around about that, you know. But I enjoyed. I performed you know, various show dances and stuff like that over the years. But the story about the pink hair lady, because it was very interesting. Her name is Wida. And I enjoyed dancing with her, and it's very interesting. And she has two dance partners, and so she's always unique, and nobody wants to say anything because, you know, like, okay, but everybody gave her space, and she's always very positive and so forth. And she
Wait,
has a thing
about.
She has
what? Two dance partners?
She has two dance partners.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, and in that sort of in her generation, that's not. You know, it's not sort of acceptable kind of thing.
Oh, okay, all right.
But no one says anything, and because she has a very positive attitude, and it was very interesting. I mean, and she's a very nice person, and so it was quite interesting. Had a good time being around her, you know, and everything else. So it was, and it just sort of rang a bell when I read about the pink hair, and I thought it was very, very interesting. And she believes, and in her case, she believes, you know, pink hair, and she has a light, tint in her hair that makes a person look younger. It's sort of like get the redness out of your. I mean it's highlights
like
your face. Yeah, glow. That there you go. That's the word that she would use. You know, and I said, interesting. Never thought about it that way. You know?
Oh, I love that. That's great.
So it was quite interesting from that, you know. So, well, in your years of being a life coach, what was the most common scenarios and challenges you have ever encountered with single moms? Because I know you coach a lot of single moms, and you being a single mom yourself. So what are the things that sort of, you know, it's a challenge that is shared by everyone?
I think the biggest one, you know, in addition to the finances, but the biggest one is how do I stay me? How do I do the work I love and stay myself while raising my kids? The tendency is to say, well, I'm going to have to just take the first job that comes along in order to support my children. Or even not just that comes along, there's also the cases when people say, I have to have that high-power career job in order to feed my family, and then the ache comes from not being able to give them enough time. So that conflict between giving the kids enough time, and because I think there's always a little bit of guilt in the background, even if it's not acknowledged, for the fact that it's a single-parent household. So we want to compensate for that, and sometimes that comes in the shape of doing some compromising. on our own choices, which in the end, you know, might or might not serve the kids. I mean, for the kids to see their parents happy, that does a lot for them. But sometimes we just feel that we have to make choices that are not going to make us happy in order to keep things going, keep the machine turning.
What are some of the favorite coaching moments that you have?
Oh, well, there's so many of them. I mean, it's just a really wonderful profession. When someone understands something, understands a pattern that they've had, and that they understand it so cleanly
mm-hmm.
that it dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean by that? Like they realize they've done something and why they've done it, and in the moment it dissolves because they get it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just, you know, it's a high on both ends of the phone. I mean, I work on the phone mostly, so it's a shared high on both ends of the phone. When someone realizes that something that has always brought them stress,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden doesn't anymore. And what happens often is that I miss out on those moments because, you know, we could work on something for 3 weeks or a
mm-hmm.
month,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden it's not an issue anymore, and they don't even mention it again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's a little bit like Santa Claus, you know, you bring the gift, but then... No, but you're not there when people open it,
right.
And you kind of move on to the next thing. But something that seems so big, all of a sudden, is not even worth mentioning anymore.
But what you help with them is that you have made a tremendous impact in them, where they have a transformation from within.
And yeah.
And it's sustaining too, which is very interesting, because I think
yes.
a lot of times, you know, we get into the situation that if we just handle symptoms, then it's just temporary. And what
yes.
you are doing, it's permanent, because you're handling core issues and making that transformation from inside out. So that makes a big difference. It's much more profound and much, it's basically permanent. I mean, you know, because it just flips, like you were saying. And then it's no longer there to be
well,
worried
you know
about.
What does happen is I see that we get pop quizzes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we get the big lesson down and then we'll get a little pop quiz coming here and there. But what I give them a lot is tools. So once someone has worked with me for enough time, they have kind of like a virtual tool chest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they know when this happens, I can grab this tool. And then, I mean, life is not going to stop throwing stuff at you. But if you have the right tool, it's
right.
much easier to fix a leak or fix a crack, you know, because you have the right tool. And now I even see... You know, clients who've kind of become friends, if I throw something at them about my life,
mm-hmm.
they will throw a tool right at me. <They'll> say, I mean, that happens a lot, especially recently. So it's really, really wonderful for me to see that they own the tools. This is
right.
not just we work together. These tools are there forever, and they can share them with friends, and they can share them with family. And so... My hope, and I think that is happening, is that I end up making a bunch of little life coaches walking around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, people, I have a program called the Everyday Life Coach, which is sharing these tools with people who are not life coaches, but who can then go out into the world and
right.
share those tools with people they meet in the street, or their kids, or their bosses, or their employees.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's just tools, and if we use them correctly or well for the need of the time, life just runs so much more smoothly.
Right. That's true. Very true. And, well, you have the spirit of sharing, and I think that's very, very important, because a lot of people don't realize that is what we do for people, making a positive difference in someone's life that actually enrich ours.
Yes. Yes, and I'm not interested in being a guru or
mm-hmm,
in. I mean, I work with my clients kind of like the way you would work with kids. You know, you work towards independence. I know I'm very successful when I see them pick up a tool
mm-hmm.
in front of me and use it,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they haven't necessarily needed me to point it out to them. And then there's always new tools that we learn, but it's very satisfying to share those so that they can use them too. They don't think, oh my gosh, I can't do this without Laura.
Right, right. You obviously have gone through a tremendous, when I look at your life and of course growing up in France and then moving here, getting married, that was a tremendous change. That was a major turning point in your life. And then, of course, having children and then getting divorced and having to be on your own, starting out all over again. Obviously, you have certain things in you that were taught to be successful, to survive. So having said that, what would you consider as the lowest point in your life that sort of all of a sudden, springboard you to a totally new dimension of success?
These seem to happen regularly, where you sort of, it's like shifting gear, something kind of grinds and doesn't feel good, and then you get to the other side and you're on a higher gear. And actually, I think I might be going through this right now, but one of the lower points was that night talking to my sister and being absolutely desperate, realizing that this is it. I'm going to be here for 15 years. What am I going to do? And being so desperate that I was willing to hear her when she said, check out life coaching, even though I had no clue what she was talking about. So that's one of the low points. Another one is, I don't know if you read in my book, there's a story called, is it called Don't Worry? I can't remember the name of the story. With the little glass piece.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's very interesting. I love the glass looks like. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you want me to share this really quickly?
Yes, please. Yes.
Because that was definitely a shifting point, too. It was the first winter that I wasn't with my kids' dad anymore, and no money. And I had the three kids and some of their friends and the dogs and the dog in the living room. And I was preparing dinner, and I was, in my mind, I was thinking, okay, it's the beginning of winter. I don't have enough wood to keep the wood stove burning for the whole winter. We only had a wood stove in the house. I have to figure out how to get more wood and, just kind of thinking, not panicky, but, trying to figure out where my solution lived. And I looked up at the wood stove, and the wood stove started to glow, glowed really brightly. And I realized, oh my gosh, I've put a log too close to the glass pane. And before I could move forward, well, the glass pane shattered. Mm-hmm. And so there was glass everywhere. The kids were there. I moved the kids out of the way, moved the dogs out of the way, got on my hands and knees to pick up the glass. It was tempered glass, so there was hundreds of little pieces. Mm-hmm. And I was on my hands and knees, and I realized, 5 minutes ago I was worried about getting enough wood, and now I don't even have a stove, because you can't use a stove without a glass pane.
Right.
I might as well have had to buy a car, than to buy the pane. It seemed so improbable. And I was literally on my hands and knees picking up the pieces of glass, and for some reason something popped into my head. I could feel my energy shifting into despair. I could feel that I was slipping, and I couldn't do that. And I said, I need to know that even in this moment, there is love and beauty. And I have no idea why I made that request. I have no idea where that came from. But those are the words I use. I need to know that even now there's love and beauty. And I picked up the next piece of glass, and it was this perfect, perfect, perfect heart-shaped piece of glass. And it was so beautiful. And I picked it up, and I held it in my hand. And this feeling that I've had several times in the course of my life, just this feeling that you get when you meditate for a while, this feeling of being grounded and peace. And just looking at that piece of glass that had just been given to me right after I had asked, I knew that everything was going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how, but I just knew that it was going to be okay. And that started a whole new momentum for me. Mm-hmm. And, things didn't change overnight, but there was something about having had such an instant answer. It was like instant messaging to the universe,
Right.
And that changed everything for me. My state of mind was completely different. And for a long time, I didn't talk about the glass except to one friend. And then eventually, I took it to workshops with me, and because, you know, it's magic for me. And it's in my book. There's a little picture of it in my book.
Yes, yes. I thought it was very interesting that you included that, because in all our lives, we don't realize it, that things that happen in our lives that are turning points. And the uniqueness about turning points is that sometimes in life, it's the most difficult time in your life is where you make the most profound revelation about all the good things is to come.
Yes.
And so we don't realize it. And that brings me actually to the second part of your title, Chocolate Cookies and Oprah. And that's very interesting, because I know, and I'm going to let you tell the story about that, because it's very, very interesting. But what I did was I got, you know, the pink hair being where, hey, we have choices here. Whether we want to live a stress-free life or we don't, there's our choice. And then, of course, with the heart in terms of the flow within ourselves, you know, we go through a tough time. Some of the most challenging moments is where we come out better and more equipped for the future, or we see something that's far beyond that we never even see. But, however, we have to realize that we have to live in the present moment. And that, Laura, is for you now to talk about Oprah and the chocolate chip cookie. Chocolate cookies.
Well, I hope she's listening. Darn it. Oprah, are you
there? You go. For both of our sakes, you know, it's like, okay.
Oprah and the chocolate cookies. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so the story goes like this. So we had a bakery, a really busy, busy bakery, and it grew sort of organically on its own, and it was quite lovely. And one day, you know, so I was always pregnant. I always had kids, and so we had this bakery, and I was always either pregnant or nursing. Or it was a very wonderful, very all-encompassing, super busy chunk of life.
Mm-hmm.
So one day I was frosting a cake or something, and the phone rang in the bakery, and we picked up the phone, and this guy said, "Hi, my name is so-and-so," and darn it, I sure wish I could remember the name, but I don't. And he said, "I was in your bakery last summer, and I bought one of your chocolate cookies." We had these really awesome chocolate cookies, the ones that are on the cover of the book. And he said, I had those cookies, and they're amazing, and I really would like you to ship me a dozen of them. And I thought, oh, what a pain in the butt, shipping cookies. That is so not what I want to do. And he said, so let me give you my address. And he said, I'm actually the producer of the Oprah show. And I had no idea what the Oprah show was. You know, it didn't sound like anything I knew. I didn't watch TV. I didn't read magazine. I just frosted cakes and nursed baby, you know, those babies. So he said, okay, here's my address. Just mail them directly to the show, and that will be great. So fine. So I shipped the darn cookies. And then 2 weeks later, he called again, or 3 weeks later. He said, oh, the cookies were such a hit. We would like three dozens, and please ship them to the show. And I still, my lights didn't go on at all. I had no idea where I was shipping the cookies. And every few weeks he would call, and every few weeks I would be so annoyed. It was such an inconvenience, you know. I had cakes to bake, and what was right under my nose was really important. But I would drag myself to the post office and ship the cookies. And then eventually, you know, he stopped calling, and I was really glad, because I had been a big nuisance. And I think about that now, and I thought, oh my gosh, what was I thinking? I mean, how often does the producer of the Oprah show call you and tells you, oh, I love your cookies, and we're serving them on the show? I mean, if this happened now, you know, in fact, I kind of have half a mind of going, I'm going to do it at some point in the next few months. I'm going to fly to Chicago, and I'm going to make those cookies, and I'm going to deliver a copy of the book and a plate of cookies to Oprah.
Hey, because, if you do that and you get on, you need, don't forget me over here in Dallas. Because I'm the one who brought this thing up.
Okay, well, we can all go.
There you go.
I'll bring your book, too. We can all go to Oprah. But
there you
go. Come on, what was I thinking? What was I thinking? So the lesson for this, there's a double lesson for this. The first lesson is you know, pay attention to what's going on. Lift your nose from the frosting and be
right.
aware. And, oh, my goodness, you know. And the other lesson is, you know that sentence that people say, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity?
Right, right, right.
You know, and then you go, oh, my gosh, I missed a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And you can use that as a crutch for the rest of your life. Like, my boat came, and I missed it, and poor mm-hmm. me. But, you know, the point is, I wasn't ready.
Right.
And this just wasn't the right time, but it doesn't mean I have to beat myself up for it.
No.
Maybe the right time is now. Maybe the right time is never. And so
right.
be it. You know, it was, you know, I don't want to sit here and mope. I laugh. I mean, it's kind of funny. I laugh a little bit. But,
right.
but you know, that's where I was at that time. I was young and I was busy and I didn't mm-hmm. know who Oprah was. So there
right.
you go.
Right. No, but I mean, it's interesting because people don't realize that sometimes it's those mundane things, I mean, you know, that we don't think that deep enough, and we don't pay attention to the present moment. And then, of course, everything is about timing. And you're right, because there are many times when we look back and say, you know, we missed this opportunity. Not necessarily. If it's meant to be, it will always come around.
Absolutely.
And I feel very good about the fact that actually, whether you deliver it yourself personally or not, but I'm very sure if you were to bake and send a dozen of cookies to any of the producers over there, they will get it, and then they'll get in touch with you. I'm very sure about that.
We're gonna do it, Johnny.
So it's quite interesting because we sometimes take things for granted, and now we realize in hindsight, things would have been different. But then it's all about timing. It is all about timing, and I believe in that.
It is. And, you know, if I had gotten the exposure then,
mm-hmm.
yes, I could have, you know, showed the world what great cookies I make. But in the last 10 years, I have
yes.
gained so much more that I can share
right,
that
right.
I would rather it took place now or next
Precisely.
Year.
Precisely.
Now would be nice.
Precisely.
But, you know, now if I get that kind of exposure, there is so much more I can give.
That's right. And maybe that's what it's all about, because back then you would have limited success. It's a one-time hit, you know, deal. It's a one-hit
right.
wonder. Here it's different because this is perpetual, being a life coach, being a lot of things that you can share. And that's what a lot of people ask me about my situation. I said, you know, that's what this is all about from My Mama's Kitchen. This is perpetual. This is not something, it's not a one-hit wonder. It's something
right.
that it's ongoing and people can enjoy. This is a lifetime thing, and it doesn't go away. It gets better each time. But this brings us to talk about your passion about organic gardening. Are you still doing it, and how has it impacted your life?
Well, you know, the way it started was also a little bit of rebellion. I had never,
mm-hmm.
ever grown anything, you know, grew up in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Except when I was little, my aunt gave me like a little indoor radish kit or something.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'd never really grown anything. And when we found ourselves living in that trailer with all that acreage, I spent
mm-hmm.
the winter learning about organic gardening. And then
mm-hmm.
The spring came, and I decided, okay, let me grow some herbs.
Mm-hmm.
Let me grow a garden. And all the advice said, start small your first year. But I didn't want I didn't like starting small. You know, I think my dad had raised me to not
mm-hmm.
think small. So we plowed this huge garden and started to grow stuff in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of the summer, I was actually selling my herbs. I mean, it was very successful, and I was delivering my herbs to restaurants and caterers, and I had developed a crazy passion for growing. I had a greenhouse, and I was just crazy passionate about growing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually how the bakery was born, out of a strange step through the garden. But and then for the past several years, I haven't really been able to garden because I've been busy and not having enough room. And this year, for the first time again, we have this beautiful garden, and it just feeds me, no pun intended. But,
yes.
You know, there's so many cliche analogies you can say about gardening. But, you know, from the weeding, and that's a big theme in my work, is the idea of decide what you're going to keep and pluck the rest and love what you're going to keep and nurture it. And that's what you do when you garden. You pull the weeds and then you make room for the plants that you decide you want to grow. And maybe somebody else would grow something different, and maybe somebody else would grow
right.
weeds. But so you pluck the weeds, you prepare the soil really well by getting rid of the rocks, you know, the stuff that's in your way. And then you pluck the weeds, and then you plant the seeds, and then you water them, and you give them sun. And the whole thing is very metaphorical for me, and it's amazing to see something, you know, you put, and the abundance, you put one seed and you end up with a plant. It's just so life affirming.
I got into, I don't do, you know, gardening at all, but certainly I enjoy seeing people doing it. And my German mom, you know, she was in France with her husband when he was working out there in Europe for several months, and one of the places that she was, they were at, was in Port Jerome, a town in Normandy in France, and
okay.
And a few other places in Brussels and Belgium and so forth. But one of the things that what influenced them, and they have a huge garden in the backyard, is because of the freshness of all the produce you can get in Europe.
Yeah.
And this was back in the early 60s, of course, and so when they got back to the States and they just decided to do that, you know, to have their own garden and everything else, so it was quite interesting how passionate they were about that. And so it was interesting that they got that from Europe, which I thought it was very, very good.
It's a simplicity,
how can,
you know, Europe is a very simple,
mm-hmm.
we like simplicity.
That's right. That's right. And so they brought a lot of that back, and I get a lot of those kind of things from her in terms of being around her and very, I guess, nature kind of situation, and which was really, really good for me. How can someone purchase your book and get in touch with you?
You can go on my website,
mm-hmm.
and that's lauralavigne.com, LauralaVigne.com.
Okay.
And you can get the book there. You can get more stories. I do a lot of writing, so there's a mm-hmm. lot of writing on my site. You can subscribe to my newsletter, and I try to send that out every month. There's a lot of me on that website, so you can go on there, and I can ship you the book. You can also download the audio,
mm-hmm.
which is me telling the book, you know, reading the stories of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You can go on there and find a whole bunch of pink hair and chocolate cookies stuff.
And you also recently started a radio show on your own. Please tell us a little bit about that, and how can the listeners tune in to listen to your show?
Well, it's brand new. So today we're going to have the third episode, and it's at noon, as opposed to the email I sent everybody saying it was going to be at 10 o'clock. But great. I sent out 400 emails saying, tune in at 10 o'clock. But
okay.
It's at noon Pacific Standard Time. So it really is 10 o'clock your time. I must have been tuning in.
That's correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's called Chez Laura, which means at Laura's place. And we discuss different topics. Today we're going to discuss a story from my book called Who the Heck Are They? Which is, you know, all these voices we have in our mind that tells
mm-hmm.
us, guides us, and sometimes they're good voices and sometimes they're less good voices. So
mm-hmm.
it's at noon Pacific Standard Time, 10 o'clock your time, and it's called Chez Laura, and you can find it on Block Talk Radio under my name, Laura Lavigne. And roll with the punches there, because we're just getting started. But it's a lot of fun. It's great. And gosh, it's, you know, I have to tell you, Johnny, I've never been interviewed before.
Oh, you did. You're doing wonderfully well. Believe me.
Well,
I mean,
it's
just
so much fun. It's so much fun. And you draw things out that, you know, I didn't even really realize were there. So it's just a really great privilege to have your guest, really.
Well,
really
thank you. I appreciate that. We are coming close to the end of the show, and for all guests on my show, do you have a recipe for living that you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
A recipe for living. I think my recipe would be, you know, a lot of people come to me telling me they want more of this, more of that, and my suggestion is, let's start with what you want less of. Kind of like the gardening thing, you know? Let's start by plucking away some of the things that no longer serve you in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So my recipe for living would be, I mean, I wish I could write a little
mm-hmm.
real recipe. I wish I had thought of that. But start by removing things that don't serve you, that don't feed you. Things that you've outgrown that don't
mm-hmm.
give you pleasure and joy. Thoughts. What thoughts do you keep running up in your head that you could let go of? Activities. Are you sure that this is still something you love doing?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you absolutely have to do it? Even relationships. Are you maintaining this acquaintanceship out of duty, or is it, press refresh, see where are you today and what is current in your life today, and
mm-hmm.
start by pulling things that no longer are current.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then that will give you room for growing and inviting things that are current. So I would say, if I were to say a recipe, the ingredients would be one part pulling what's no longer current, one part really cherishing what you have that
mm-hmm.
is fresh in your life and nurturing it, and then one part inviting magic
mm-hmm.
and being willing to be surprised by ingredients that you didn't know were in your cupboards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because you covered it in the end of the book with regards to the gift of not knowing.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very interesting. And I think, just... there's an element of faith and trusting and everything else. Well, Laura, thank you for the great recipes and spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. And to all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning. Please join me next Tuesday morning as we continue with our theme From My Mama's Kitchen Recommends. My guest will be Patty Handy. She is a money coach and author, How to Ditch Your Allowance and Be Richer Than Your Parents. 9 wealth building tools. Yeah, it's very interesting. 9 wealth building tools to make teen rich. We'll be discussing her new book, her passion in helping teens and young adults by empowering them with financial wisdom. For additional information, isn't that interesting? And for additional information, please, about this show or future shows, or for my weekly recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Twitter.com/FMMK Talk Radio. Thank you for listening and have a great week. And Laura, thank you again and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.